This is Pillow Talk, brought to you by Killer and a Sweet Thing. I'm Eileen Kelly.
And I'm Jacob Safarian. On this podcast, we normalize sexual experiences by allowing the people who live them to speak for themselves.
On today's episode, we're joined by Professor of Human Sexuality at New York University, Dr. Zhanna Vrengolova. She's been quoted in Teen Vogue, Cosmopolitan, and Huffington Post. In addition to her research, she founded the Casual Sex Project, an online forum where people of all ages share honest accounts of casual encounters. Dr. Zhanna, welcome to Pillow Talk. So I guess let's start off with, how would you define the term non-monogamous?
Non-monogamous just means, well, non-monogamous in and of itself just means that you are, or in this case, I am not romantically and or sexually involved with only one person, but multiple people. And you can do that in a non-consensual way, which is the way most people do it, aka cheating, or you can do it in consensual ways, which is, you know, with the express knowledge and understanding of everybody involved. So if you have a partner, right now I don't, but when I do have partners, that's always understood that and very explicitly negotiated that we will be at least sexually not exclusive.
Got it. And so what are the common types of non-monogamous relationships?
Yeah, that's a good question. It can come in lots of shapes and forms. When I teach about this, I like to show this graph by a poly activist called Franklin Vo, who created it in 2010, I think. It's a big graph. It's like this mess of forms and sizes and shapes and things and overlapping, you know, circles and descriptions of the different types of poly. So there are lots of different ways of doing consensual non-monogamy or non-monogamy in general. I guess the two main types are the poly and the swinger type, with poly being organized around multiple romantic, long-term, romantic, loving, emotionally committed relationships that are obviously not exclusive and everybody knows about everyone. Or you can have a more couple-centric type of consensual non-monogamy, so more of the swinging or maybe an open relationship kind of thing where you have one person that you are romantically and emotionally involved with only having kind of casual sex, casual interactions with other people. And you can have those together, which is the more typical swinger type. Like, you know, we go to parties and we have sex with other people.
We watch each other.
Or, you know, we bring in another couple and we swap, or we bring another woman, a man, whatever, you know, whatever gender floats people's boats. But it's mostly casual, right? Or it can be more of the open relationship, I guess, type, even though open relationship is sometimes used as the umbrella term, as kind of a synonym for consensual non-monogamy overall. But a more narrow definition for open relationship that some people use is the form where you have the couple-centric, romantic, long-term relationship, but we see people kind of on the side, but it's more casual. These other people that we're seeing, we don't necessarily see them together. We see them separately, but it's more casual. And these are very rough kinds of distinctions, because very often you have a mix of things that end up happening. You know, you might, let's say we start establishing a relationship saying, oh, we're just going to do casual sex with other people, but then maybe somebody develops a bit more
feelings for someone else,
for one of those partners. So maybe the majority of the partners are going to be casual sex only, but then there are going to be some people that you end up maybe having something more, or maybe you're like, yeah, we just want to do this together, but then maybe every now and then, maybe when you travel, you can have a separate experience. So there's a lot of fluidity in this.
So does everybody establish these sort of boundaries amongst their own couplings about like what they're comfortable with their partner?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no one right way to do non-monogamy. I always like to say, for people who may have read Anna Karenina, Tolstoy's book that starts with all happy families are happy in the same way and all unhappy families are unhappy in their own way.
It didn't really work out that great for Anna Karenina, though.
Well, yeah, she was quite unhappy. You can think of all monogamous relationship being kind of monogamous in the same way, because there's only one rule. You don't do anything with anyone else. I don't do anything with anyone else, period. Like, that is the rule. And very often it's an unstated rule that we just kind of assume that that's what's going to be. But all non-monogamous relationships are non-monogamous in their own way. They all have a different set of rules and agreements that the people involved with them are going to come up with. And those often change over time. Very often you get together and you're like, this is what I think I'm comfortable with. This is what I want to do. Okay, let's try that. These are the rules. And then you do that for a bit. And then you're like, actually, this is not really working out. Or maybe I want this as well. Or this one thing that I thought that I was really going to be bothered by, I'm not really bothered by it. So let's bring that in. So you kind of...
It shifts and flows.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what are some of the things that encourage these shifts within a relationship? Just personal changes in your mood and...
Oh, it can be a lot of different things. Sometimes you have big changes in one or both partners' lives, like you move or you have a child or you change jobs or you have a sick parent that you have to take care of, you know, something major like that. You might even entirely close it off if it was open, or then reopen it again if it was closed for a while or something. And sometimes it's just having these experiences. Let's say, you know, we're in a relationship and I say, you know, I really don't feel, you know, I feel, let's say, insecure about women who have bigger breasts than me. Right. I don't want you hooking up with anyone with bigger boobs than me. Right. Or whatever it is. And then, I don't know, at some point we find ourselves at a party or something. And I feel
you
particularly
spot that girl with the big boobs.
Yeah.
And you're feeling attracted to her.
Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I think that's OK. Let's give this a try. Right. And then we do it. And I'm like, oh, that wasn't that bad at all. So it can be just personal experiences that you have, whether positive or negative, within the relationship that can lead to some of these changes. Very often people will start with lots of rules because there are a lot of things that they fear might be triggers for them that are going to make them feel uncomfortable. And then as they get more and more comfortable and stable in the relationship and they see, look, my partner's not leaving me, because that's the ultimate fear, right? That this is going to end, that my partner is going to fall in love with someone else or run off or figure out that somebody else is better than me somehow. And that's going to affect, you know, my status in this relationship. And as you do non-monogamy for some time and you realize no matter the kinds of people that your partner ends up interacting with or how or where or when, if they're still there for you and present and engaged and involved and loving and caring and all that, you're like, okay, this, you know, I don't have to fear all these things that I feared. So you kind of become more and more open to getting rid of some of those restrictions.
And where do those fears come from? Mm-hmm. Like jealousy, for example. Mm. You know, I feel like most people are worried about even having a threesome in their relationship because they're afraid that their partner is going to leave them for that girl or that woman or man or whatever.
Jealousy is a very, very natural response that humans have to the real or potential or imagined threat of losing your partner. When you've established a long-term bond, an attachment bond with another human being, that's really necessary for our mental health, for our survival, for our physical and emotional well-being. That is our attachment figure. And breaking that attachment bond, that's hard. That's distressing. That's, you know, we don't want that. And so jealousy is just a natural response that makes you react to the possibility of your partner leaving.
You.
Yeah. And so everything kind of boils down to that. Whether, now you can have different flavors of it, if you will. It can be more about feeling insecure about yourself, like I was saying about the boobs, or, you know, something else about your anatomy or your intelligence or your, you know, whatever it is that you might feel insecure about. Or maybe it is about how your partner interacts with other people or how much attention you are getting from your partner. Some people are very attentive, very loving, very caring, and other people are not necessarily so much. So it can have different flavors. And then there's the possessiveness.
Yeah, I was going to say, can we talk about ownership?
Yeah, that's somewhat different from jealousy. I think often we lump those together, but that's a different element. That's a kind of a different experience of possessiveness, of the feeling of this is my girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, right? And that has more to do, I think, with ego, with, I mean, there is an element of fear of losing that person, but it's more about these expectations that are placed on us about, you know, what are others going to think if I allow my partner to have sex with other people or something like that. And it seems like
a lot of stigma.
Yeah, exactly. And biologically speaking, I mean, we're still figuring all this out, and it's not as clear-cut as I'm going to make it sound, but it seems like, to some extent, there are different neurotransmitters that mediate these two different kind of feelings. With oxytocin, what most people know as the love chemical or whatever,
the liquid orgasm.
Yeah, liquid trust or whatever. So it's a neurotransmitter that gets produced in the body when you have an orgasm. I mean, throughout the sexual experience, but especially during the moment of orgasm, and also during breastfeeding, during childbirth. So it really seems like it plays a role in bonding. Bonding mm-hmm. between mother and child, bonding between partners. And that seems to be the substrate of that attachment bond, that closeness, which if you feel like you're losing, you're going to feel this insecurity and jealousy. On the other hand, it seems like there's this other neurotransmitter called vasopressin, which is more prevalent in males, male animals and men, it seems like. And that can also be implicated in bonding, but it seems like that's more of the possessive type
okay.
of the territorial kind of, this is my area, this is my partner, don't touch it kind of thing. So
do you think some of the people who are more possessive just have more... could it be a biological factor?
It's possible. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think
or both possessiveness. Factor.
It can be that too, absolutely. Nothing in humans is... Yeah. Either or, you know, there are many people out there who would like to say everything is conditioned and other people who say everything is biology. And I think that's completely unreasonable.
Yeah.
We have plenty of evidence for every aspect of human sexuality and human personality that both are involved. So, of course, you can have some biological predispositions to be more this way or more that way. And then depending on what is happening in your life, what has been happening in your life from the moment you were born, those experiences are also going to shape to what extent that predisposition is going to go one way or another.
Or another,
yeah. You know, all of these biological predispositions, they are just that, predispositions. They have some leeway around them depending on what circumstances you're going to find yourself in, which way it's going to go and to what extent it's going to get expressed. The first memory I have of something in the direction of non-monogamy was probably with my first sort of boyfriend that I had when I was 13. I started early, much earlier than most people. And during that time, I thought that, you know, when you're on your period, you shouldn't be having sex. And, you know, we would be fooling around or whatever. And I'd be like, you know, you really should go and find someone else to have sex with when I can't, like on the days when I'm on my
at
period.
At 13?
Yeah.
Wow. What did he say to that?
Progressive.
He thought it was crazy. Yeah, he was like, no, you don't do that when, you know, you are with someone. I'm like, but why not? And to me, it just made no sense why he wouldn't do that. Yeah, I was never particularly...
Conventional.
Or
jealous.
For me, no, I was super low on jealousy always. And I could not really stay faithful and be... monogamy made no sense to me. I felt no need to be with just one person. I knew that you were supposed to. Like, that's what they were telling
socially,
us that
yeah.
you were supposed to do. Even when I was most in love, I had a long-term relationship with a woman for about 5 years, and she was the love of my life. I was so deeply in love with her, and I still desired other people. You know, because up until that point, people had been trying to convince me, herself included, that when you truly love someone, you don't desire other people. That just made no sense to me. I still, you know, I was in love with her as much one can be in love with someone, I think. I'm yet to be more in love with somebody, and that's 20 years later, and I still desired other people. And being
with
other
people. Did you ever go through on those desires?
Yeah, I may have.
That's fine. And, I mean, it's fair. I'm glad you're being honest.
Yeah. And, you know, she knew, and that didn't go over very well. And I was trying, you know, I was going back and forth between, you know, trying real hard and then failing, and then trying real hard again, failing again. And it just made no sense, because all of those experiences that I would have with other people had no bearing whatsoever on how I felt.
Love.
Yeah. How I felt towards her, or how I acted with her, or how our relationship was. Like, that, to me, that was completely independent and separate. And we sort of tried to do, she was so convinced, so convinced that monogamy was the way to go. And she kind of gave it a shot. We kind of tried having a threesome once or twice before, you know, over the course of the years. And it would always be just so hard for her.
And was it mostly jealousy for her, or...
I don't even know if it was jealousy. She was not a particularly jealous person. Like, we would flirt with other people, and that was totally fine. And she was pretty confident about everything. It was a moral value that when you love someone, you just
You're only with them.
Yeah, you don't desire other people. And if you desire other people, that means you don't love this person. You know, this bidirectional kind of understanding that this is what love is. And if you don't feel this way, that means you're not in love.
Socially, what do you think the history is for that?
Oh, God.
Like, is it coming from religion and that you're only with one person to procreate or?
Sure. I think religion plays a role. Any kind of sex negative understanding and the marriage being and you know, socially needing marriage to have the kind of social organization that we have that is very couple centric, like a single couple centric, where you have the patrilineal way of inheritance and all that. So that's a pretty complicated. But the reality is, in many, many societies across the world, some level of infidelity, even when you did have marriage, even when you did have this one-on-one kind of coupling long-term for social reasons, you still had a lot of tolerance for people having other partners, especially men, right, having other partners. And when you look at the world overall, something like 70-75% of all cultures have some level of non-monogamy, at least in marital patterns, they allow for non-monogamy for the men. Right? And that is not to say that all of those societies, you have all men marry non-monogamously or multiple, you know, having multiple wives and such, but that is at least allowed. And at least
that's the
some
more socially.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, can it still be called non-monogamy if it's not consensual with both partners?
I mean, that's all non-monogamy.
Yeah.
It's the consensual versus the non-consensual part. So that's why you need the CNM, the consensual non-monogamy or ethical non-monogamy, because just non-monogamy, that doesn't carry any of that, is this consensual or not. That is just a description of behavior, that you are having multiple partners. And the context of those multiple partners, how much they know about each other and all that, that's not captured by just the word non-monogamy.
Have you been shamed over your life for this lifestyle, especially maybe when you were younger?
Maybe. I've been incredibly lucky to have super thick skin and to have developed super thick skin. I mean, I heard a lot of, I guess, attempts at slut shaming, just more generally, not just because of monogamy or not monogamy. I was always interested in having multiple partners. I loved casual sex. I never felt the need to be in love or in a relationship with somebody in order to have sex with them. And I was a highly hypersexual kid from the moment I can remember about myself. And so there certainly were kind
moments.
Of moments and people, you know, calling me names or not wanting to be my friends because of that or something. But for some reason, it never really truly affected me. Somebody early on in my life, I think it was a neighbor, an older woman who lived downstairs, who gave me this quote, I think by Oscar Wilde, that said, "The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about." And I kind of latched onto that early on. I was like, hell yeah. Yeah, sure.
Like they can remember me.
You know what? Yeah, and I don't know. I reveled in being a rebel. I liked being a rebel. I liked pushing the boundaries. And I think some of us have that luxury because we are robust enough in terms of our mental health that we can take that on. We have that thick skin that we can say, you can say whatever the hell you want. That's not going to affect me. As long as I have some people who like me, some people who accept me, I'll be fine. And I always knew that, you know, I'll be fine. And I'll, you know, people would say, well, you don't know how to cook and you know, you're slutty and this and that. Because, you know, gender, pretty traditional gender norms where I grew up in Macedonia. And they're like, nobody ever is going to marry you. And I said, well, I don't want them to marry me if that's why they're marrying me for. I would rather stay not married than have to, like, learn how to cook or, you know, whatever.
Clean and have kids for someone.
Again, having that conversation. I think it was the same neighbor who was like, oh, you, no one's ever going to marry you. And I was like, I'll find someone maybe from a different culture who's going to marry me, who doesn't think that you need to be, a virgin at marriage or whatever, or who thinks that you have to cook as a woman in order to be marriage material. And sure enough, I did find someone.
Yeah.
When was the first time you had, a non-monogamous relationship where both you and your partner are on the same page?
That's probably my husband or ex-husband at this point.
Oh, so y'all had an open marriage?
Yeah, we had an open marriage from the very beginning, pretty much. And we met in the non-monogamous community. We met through a couple that we were both hooking up with. sort of, at around the same time. Actually, I met him very soon after I moved to the U.S. A couple of months after I moved, I met this couple partying, and then I came to New York to visit again because I was up in Ithaca doing my PhD. But I would come down to the city often to get my big city fix. And on one of those trips, I met him. He was dating somebody else at the time. And we became friends, but we didn't actually hook up for another 3 years or so. We kind of acquaintances, see each other at some birthday parties or whatever. And then 3 years later, we started hooking up. And so it was very clear to both of us that neither, at that point, we had both been in previous relationships, we had been thinking about what kind of relationship we want, and we were both very committed to non-monogamy.
Hmm. What made you decide to get married? Because to me, a lot of people think of marriage as like this commitment of not seeing anyone else.
A symbol of monogamy, at least in some ways.
It, for a lot of people, it's a symbol of monogamy. And I do get that question, like, why would you get married if you don't? Commitment and monogamy are two completely different things. Commitment in psychology, when we define commitment just, it refers to the intention to be together with someone, to stay together with someone. It's commitment to being together with this person. It doesn't tell you how you plan on being with this person. It just means that you intend to continue a relationship with this person. You're committed to the relationship, and you can be committed monogamously or you can be committed non-monogamously. Yeah. So those two things are not really connected, don't have to be connected, even though they are in many people's minds. Why did I get married? I was never one of those people who was dying to get married. In fact, most people, when I got married, they were like, who are you? Yeah. What are you talking about? But that was a way for me to kind of make things easier for myself to stay in the U.S. And we were a real couple for a good 7 years or so. And then about a year and a half ago, we decided to kind of go our own separate ways. But we're still super good friends. We are still occasional roommates. So he actually spends a lot of time in Colorado and spends maybe a week or two a month in the city. And when he's here, we share a house, a two-bedroom apartment that each of us has their own. It's like roommates, right? Each of us has their own bedroom. And then he's sometimes there and sometimes not. And we're super close friends, which I think is the best way to end. And I don't even think of it as an end.
It's just a new chapter.
Yeah, I think of it as a transition. We transition from being, partners, romantic partners, to being occasional roommates with the occasional benefit.
How do you practice safe sex while, being with multiple partners or
using condoms for vaginal and anal sex with the vast majority of partners? Every now and then I make a decision to forego condoms for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And I don't use condoms for oral. And then I get tested every 3 months on the dot. I don't think there's one right way to do this, to do safer sex. We all have different levels of comfort with risk.
Yeah.
We all have different levels of risk behavior, what kinds of sex you're having, what are the rates of certain STIs or whatever in the communities or the partners that you're having sex with. And then, how okay are you with getting something and then dealing with that? Yeah. There are people who think if you get herpes, that's it. And there are other people who are like, you get herpes, no big deal.
It's like 80% of people have herpes.
Some form, yeah.
Well, yeah, it seems like something like
75, 80.
70 have herpes 1, have the
oral.
The oral herpes. And then it seems like about 15% have the genital herpes. But for some people, it's like, look, if I get the flu once a year, that is going to be, that is going to affect my life so much more negatively for that week or so that I'm going to be in bed and miserable and not able to do
chlamydia
anything.
And going
even getting a herpes outbreak, genital herpes outbreak, if I get that outbreak, say, once a year, which is for many people, that's a typical number of outbreaks that they'll get. The only thing you can do during that time is have sex. Everything else you can do. You can go to work, you can go party, you can go hang out with your friends, you can hang out with your partner, you can, do stuff to your partner that doesn't involve your own genitals. Nothing is affected except your sex life. Whereas if you come down with the flu, your entire life is affected and miserable. And so I'm not saying that anybody should feel in any particular way. We all have different levels of comfort, and that's okay. So I think everybody needs to figure out what is their own way of doing safe sex or safer sex that makes them feel good.
Not using condoms for oral. I actually got a DM about that today. So I'd want to hear your reasoning.
There is certainly evidence that some things can be transmitted through oral. So chlamydia and
gonorrhea,
HPV, which can cause oral cancer or throat cancer or something like that. Those can be transmitted orally. HIV really can't. So again, it depends on what is your level of comfort
with risk.
You know, that for me, I am perfectly fine if I get chlamydia or gonorrhea, throat chlamydia or gonorrhea. I'm totally fine with that. I accept that risk, and hasn't happened yet. As I said, I get tested. And that's another thing people don't realize, that chlamydia and gonorrhea are actually site specific. So when you get, when you pee in a cup for gonorrhea, chlamydia, or if you get a swab, a genital swab that will test for genital, you know, chlamydia or gonorrhea, that doesn't capture the possibility of having throat gonorrhea
or
chlamydia.
or anal.
Exactly. So when I go and get tested, I do the
everything.
I pee in a cup, then I do an anal swab, a vaginal swab, and a throat swab.
And do you do blood testing as well?
And a blood testing for HIV and syphilis. Yeah. And so, and thus far, I have not gotten chlamydia or gonorrhea in my throat, and who knows, maybe that will happen one day. And if it does, I'm totally fine dealing with that. I mean, chlamydia and gonorrhea, as far as I'm concerned, are a pretty simple thing. And as far as HPV goes, again, that's a risk you decide that you're willing to take or not willing to take. And luckily, we have a vaccine for HPV, for the worst strains, the 9 strains which cause genital warts and the other 5 cause cancer. I didn't do that math right. 7, the other 7 that cause different types of cancers, right? We have a vaccine, and I'm vaccinated against it, and so I feel pretty comfortable doing that. Also, the risk of oral and throat cancer is pretty, pretty low. It's certainly not zero, but it's a relatively uncommon type, or both of those are relatively uncommon types of cancers.
So in your I know every non-monogamous relationship has different rules and different sets, but when you and your partner saw other people separately, did you have like a code where like you have to come home and tell me what you did exactly? Because I've had friends who are like, they have to tell me what they did with who and exactly where and how it went down.
Right, right. As we said, this is very individual, and people are going to decide how they want to go about it. When we were first starting out, we had a rule that we were only going to play with other people separately when one of us was traveling. That we weren't going to do that when we were both in the same city. If we were in the same city, then we would play together with other people, but not go on separate dates. So that was the initial. And then the rule around sharing, if we had been with somebody else when one of us was traveling, was, well, my ex wanted me to not disclose unless he asked. He wanted to ask the question. And he would ask the question when he felt comfortable, sort of asking or felt good about things or whatever. So he didn't want me to just tell him that if there was a particular time when he was feeling vulnerable for other reasons or whatever. He wanted to be in control of when he got that information. And then that changed over the years. Yeah, that certainly changed. As I was saying in the beginning, as he became more comfortable and more confident that, you know, this, we are a thing and I'm not going to leave and this is, you know, working out, then he became more comfortable hearing about it, and it would often be the first thing he asks. Or then at some point it was like, oh, just tell me whenever. It happened. And then eventually we got to the point where we could go on separate dates even when we were in the same city. And so, we had that very typical progression of fewer and fewer restrictions, as long as pretty much at one point toward the end, we got to the point of just use a condom. That was kind of the only rule, more or less, that stayed. There were some more. But most of the rules in our relationship were because he had some insecurities and aspects of jealousy that he had to deal with or needed some time and support getting over. And I don't know, just something about, I just don't feel it.
When you saw other people, would you say like, oh, I have a husband? Was it very important for you, or do you think it's important to disclose that sort of information to someone you're about to be intimate with? Or
I think of it as a case-by-case scenario.
Yeah.
I know that there are some people who say that's absolutely important. And if it is important to you, then by all means do it, right? I would never lie about it if I was asked, but I didn't necessarily always
bring it up
immediately. And it also depends on the context in which you meet. You know, sometimes you meet people at parties. And
it's
sometimes
a one-night only thing.
And exactly. You're not having those conversations. It's kind of irrelevant. Now, if I was going to have something more serious with someone, or if there were some repeated visits and all that, they would certainly find out. I mean, I was not in any way secretive about it. You know, it was on my Facebook that I was married. You know.
Have you ever felt judged by or been rejected because you were married?
Yeah, for sure. There are a number of times, especially less so for super casual stuff, or there have been a few cases where people felt uncomfortable about that, but certainly for something more like, you know, more of a dating kind of situation.
Yeah, they just couldn't get behind.
Yeah, for sure. And most of my partners are men who seem to care somewhat less, especially in these casual interactions, seem to care a little less about, you know, are you married? Do you have a boyfriend or not? Especially if you tell them, oh, you know, we're open and they're fine with it. On the other hand, for my ex, he found that was a barrier. Say if he had been with someone and not told them that he was married, and then that person found out, that they would be very unhappy and
feel used
and betrayed and all that.
I guess I get that to a smaller extent, because I remember talking with some of my friends about how sometimes when I engage in a lot of casual sex, but sometimes I'll be with someone and I'm not expecting to call them in the morning, but there's something sexy about the possibility and the hope in a sexual situation, which I think gets into something bigger, like, am I projecting love onto people I'm not in love with because I really want to be in love? But that's a different question.
He's like, that's a different podcast.
That's a different But I mean, it speaks to that. So like, how much soul searching do you have to do before actually deciding like, I'm like emotionally capable of doing this?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on how you want to play this out, and what are some of your hang-ups around that, and what are your motivations. I think it's good to do some soul searching. I think it's good, especially if you already have a long-term partner, to really think about why are you doing this, and how are you going to do it, and how are you going to make sure that it's not going to, you know, shake up your relationship and create issues and all that.
Yeah, I was just wondering what you think that has to do with gender roles, that the men you were sleeping with were fine with it, whereas the women your ex was sleeping with weren't.
That gets into a very big and long conversation, which we can't possibly have in the time that we have available, in terms of the gender differences in interest in casual sex or comfort with casual sex, that I think is driven both by some biological, you know, differences in how women and men, you know, see relationships and sex, but also a lot of social conditioning and norms around what is and isn't acceptable. And I think very often for women, even though it's casual sex, you kind of want to know that maybe, you know, maybe there's a possibility, right? So a lot of the time when women go into casual sex, they want to feel like I'm fine having this hookup, but if everything goes fine, if this, you know, the sex is good and we get along well and all that, I want to know that there is some possibility of something developing later on. Whereas if that's not an option at all because this person is married, then, you know, that's why even go there kind of thing. Whereas I think men have fewer hangups about just
casual
things being
sex.
Super casual. Yeah.
So when you deal with like the normative notion that like fidelity is defined by physical parameters, when you know, you open up your relationship like that, is there such thing as cheating or
that's a good question.
A betrayal of trust?
Yeah, maybe not cheating, although you can certainly be cheating depending on what the rules are, right? If we have a rule that, you know, you can't have sex with our friends or my friends or my family members or whatever, and you do that, like, I think that would still, that would be considered cheating. Although I think it's more appropriate to think of it as breaking of agreements because you have specific agreements, and those can sometimes be very similar to the idea of cheating. Oh, you like hooked up with someone that you were not supposed to, or you had a certain sexual act. Like some people might have rules around, well, you can't have vaginal sex with people, you can only have oral, or you can't have anal, whatever, you know, whatever your specific set of rules are. And let's say you did that, that would be considered cheating. But sometimes it might have to do with how you went about it. Maybe, you know, not using a condom. If you had a condom rule, that is a breaking of agreement, even though it's not cheating.
I guess, though, you know, it's interesting because, like, I've never been in a non-monogamous relationship, but I think I would derive comfort from it. Like, when you have an agreement and you honor that agreement, it at least shows that before this interaction with that person, you're thinking about your partner, or you're, like, mm-hmm. you know, actively choosing to follow through on something mm-hmm. y'all established.
It sounds yeah. like it takes more trust to me, or like a certain level of trust. Oh, and yeah, absolutely. And like a high level of respect for your partner.
In your professional opinion, what are some good ways to bring up with your partner that you're interested in maybe opening your relationship or pursuing a more non-monogamous lifestyle?
Lots of different ways, I think. Different things would work for different people. Sometimes it's about mentioning that you read something or you heard something or you talked to somebody or, you know, you listened to this podcast and it made you think about it. And so, you know, how exactly you're going to bring it up really depends. And often that will bring up the fear in the other partner that, oh, you don't love me anymore, or this is not working out for you.
Yeah, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah. And so I think when you are bringing it up, it's really important to put in a lot of reassurance that you are enjoying this relationship, that you are in love with your partner, that you're not interested in leaving or anything, that this is, you know, let them know why, you know, what is the reason that you have this desire? Is it that you want different kind of sex? Is it that you want some, you know, sexual novelty? Is it maybe you have some kinky desires that your partner doesn't share that you want to meet elsewhere? Maybe it's a gender of a, you know, obviously a person can have only one gender at a time, especially. And so if you want other body parts to play with or something like that, or maybe you want other needs met that you don't have in that current relationship because you don't share certain interests and preferences or whatever. And so I think sharing those kinds of things openly, but putting a lot of, or giving a lot of reassurance that you really enjoy this and you really love your partner and you want to continue, you just want to bring this additional dimension into your lives.
Because that's always something that comes in the back of my mind is, like, if someone were to approach me, you know, with, like, I want to pursue something that I'm maybe not getting here, I immediately go to, well, what am I not giving you that you want? But we've established that I'm, like, lonely and petty and insecure. So
yeah, but, I mean, you can think about that. It's funny that when it comes to sex, you know, we accept in relationships that your partner can't meet every single need that you have, right? We have lots of different needs, not sexual, any other needs in life that you might have. Some things will be met by your partner, but you might have, you know, you might love to play tennis and your partner doesn't like to play tennis or can't play tennis because they have a knee injury or something like that, right? And so we all fully accept that you might then go find another tennis partner. And that's quite okay that you're going to find some time when you go and play tennis with somebody else and nobody feels like they're not enough because they can't play tennis with their partner and partner really wants to do that. You know, we do other things together and that's okay, right? But when it comes to sex, there's this expectation that, well, this one partner is going to meet every single need that you have. And that's necessarily true. Reasonable. And I can love the sex that we're having
And still want something different with someone else.
And, you know, it might not even be something that you're not getting specifically. You might have the kinkiest, craziest, most fun, you know, most frequent, whatever. So it's not that you're not getting enough or that you're not getting the it's just diversity, novelty. You know, some of our brains, you know, I mean, we all to some extent like novelty, but some really love novelty. You know, some of us absolutely run on novelty, and having novel experiences, novel is just like a different body that smells differently, that kisses differently, that touches differently, that has a different, you know, person that has a different rhythm while penetrating, and whatever it is, you know, it can be a very similar, let's say you just have plain old vanilla kinds of desires, straight vanilla, you know, desires, and you have a type. It's all, you know, tall blonde men, whatever.
With blue eyes.
But you just want lots of them. Lots of tall blonde men with blue eyes.
I'm interested to know. So when people enter maybe having a threesome with their partner or entering an open relationship to compromise for their partner. Mm. So maybe deep down they're actually very uncomfortable with it. I'm interested to know in your experience with these kinds of situations and, like, research, do those types of non-monogamous relationships work out? Are they healthy?
Some level of compromise is okay. You know, sometimes we can decide to take one for the team, sort of. Let's say we have a rule that we always play together, and let's say there's this couple, and I really like, you know, one of the people or two of the people, but you don't as much. And so, you know, sometimes you feel comfortable kind of being like, you know, it's okay. I'm not like super into this, but yeah, I'm not like super not against into it either. Yeah. Yeah. So I can be okay having this threesome or this foursome this time. And it's also, I think, not necessarily detrimental if you're not sure whether this lifestyle is for you at all, but you want to give it a try because your partner wants it. Right. It's not something that you would have thought of, you know, thinking about it when your partner brings it up and you're like, I don't think that's for me, but I'm willing to explore. I'm willing to experiment. So let's set up some parameters and maybe give each other some time. Maybe let's say, let's try this for maybe one time, or let's try that for three times, or let's try it for 3 months or whatever, whatever.
Like a test run.
Test run. Exactly. And then evaluate and see how it feels. So let's say you're ambivalent, you're kind of on the fence. I don't know if this is for me or not. And then you try it and then you know. You know, you're asking like, how many people are there who want to do this and don't think they can? And I think more and more these days, people are becoming aware that this is an option, that complete and utter monogamy for the, you know, forever and ever is not necessarily viable as a long-term possibility, as a lifelong kind of thing. And so you don't have to be crazy open. You don't have to be in a relationship where you're having orgies, you know, every weekend or something. I mean, you could.
That sounds nice, though.
To some people, that might sound nice. And for other people, that might be like, oh my God. And very often people, I think, have that stereotype in their heads that this is what an open relationship must look like.
Yeah,
like
it's if so we're extreme.
Open, yeah, it's like it's going to be hookups every day or every weekend, crazy orgies, and my partner is always going to be with somebody else and whatnot. And that's not the case at all. You can have an agreement where you're like, maybe once a year, you know, we have a little threesome, or maybe, you know, once a year you get a hall pass when you're traveling and you can hook up with somebody else and that's it. And even having that little bit of leeway every now and then, that can be enough for some people. So your listeners are probably on the younger side of things. Please think about whether some level of non-monogamy will play into your life at some point. Be aware that very often when you first get together with someone, you have that big infatuation. You think, this is it. This is going to be the love of my life forever and ever and ever, and I'm never going to want somebody else. And that'll last for maybe a year, maybe two, maybe five. But very often at one point, you get to the point of starting to notice other people and maybe wanting to be with other people. So don't get yourself into a relationship where you think that you might want non-monogamy at one point, and you're absolutely certain that your partner is going to want complete and full monogamy. Have that conversation early on. Even if you don't open up the relationship, even if you start completely monogamous, maybe have that conversation relatively early on. Just like you're going to have a conversation about, you know, do you want kids? Do you want to live in the suburbs versus the city? Like, whatever it is that is important to you for how you're going to live your life. Are you Republican or Democrat? You know, I don't know. Whatever. Are you religious? You know, whatever matters to you for your...
Are you vegan?
Are you vegan? Exactly. Do you want a dog?
What are your preferences? Yeah, it's fair.
Like, all of those things, whatever matters to you. And, you know, to one person, whether you're vegan or not might not matter at all. And to somebody else, that might be the most important thing that matters for their long-term partner. So whatever matters to you,
yeah,
you should get those kinds of information about your partner before you commit to marrying them and, you know, having kids with them. And
sole partner for the rest of your quote-unquote life.
So this should be one of those things that you take into consideration. It's very easy to kind of suppress those needs and desires early on. But, you know, thinking down the line, thinking 5 years, 10 years, 15 years down the line, just keep that in mind.
For more content on how sexuality dictates our lives, you can visit us at www.killerandasweetthing.com and follow us on Instagram at birds.bees. To keep up with Dr. Zhanna's work, you can visit her website, drzhanna.com. That's drzhanna.com. And find her on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Dr. Zhanna. She also has a podcast called The Science of Sex. This is Pillow Talk.